Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, my name is Ian Drake, and this is the New Books Network. I'm joined today by Violet Muller. She is a historian and writer based in Oxford, England. She received her PhD in intellectual history from Edinburgh University, where she wrote her dissertation on the library of a 16th century scholar. She's the author or co-author of three reference books for the publishing arm of Bodleian Library. The Map of Knowledge, which is the book we're discussing today, is her first narrative history. The full title is The Map of Knowledge, A Thousand-Year History of How Classical Ideas Were Lost and Found. Violet, thank you so much for joining us on the New Books Network.
Thank you very much for having me.
So this is a history of the, as your subtitle talks about, the tracing of a thousand years. And this is truly a grand narrative where you trace how ancient texts were preserved and sometimes lost in their migration through the ancient world into the medieval world, and eventually into what we think of as the modern world. So I begin these interviews where I ask what motivated you to write the book, but I'm going to be so presumptuous as to tell you why I think you wrote the book, because it's one of the reasons I wanted to read it, which is I couldn't find a single narrative history about how ancient texts survived. And this certainly promises to be that. So is that the reason you wrote it?
Yes, it is. So when I studied history, I my first degree was classics and combined with medieval history. So I kind of had both sides of the story. But there seemed to me to be a big disconnect in the general narrative, as you say, you know, that it's very much in the Western tradition, we're taught that, you know, there were the Greeks and there were the Romans and then it was the Renaissance. And I felt that when it came to intellectual history, there was just a huge gap of, you know, where did these ideas go in that thousand year period between the Romans and the Renaissance? So that's absolutely what motivated me. Yes.
And so in order to have this discussion, there's a great many texts that are available in different, what we could call genres of inquiry or areas of inquiry and knowledge. But you concentrate on three particular ancient writers. So discuss those particular writers and why they're important to you.
Yes, so I became very interested in science, the history of science, when I was doing my thesis. And so I decided I wanted to focus on scientific subjects rather than, you know, literature or philosophy or all the other possibilities. And when I started looking at ancient science, it seemed very clear immediately that there were three major areas of investigation, and they were mathematics, astronomy, and medicine. So within those three subjects, I then looked at which writers I could focus on, and more importantly, which texts, because this is an enormous story. And I realized quite early on in my research that if I didn't choose and choose things to follow and be quite religious about or strict about following them, I would just get lost, and so would the reader in this enormous kind of in this enormous story. So in mathematics, that there is an obvious text which is written by Euclid, which is called The Elements, which is the sort of, it's the the foundation text of mathematics, basically, and still is today, remains as important now as it was when it was written in 300 BC. So that was obvious. And then I looked at astronomy, and there was a similar book written by Ptolemy called The Almagest, which did the same kind of thing. It was actually based on the elements, was very inspired by the elements. The structure was the same in many ways. And also Ptolemy used Euclidean geometry in order to, for his cosmological ideas. So that was obvious. And then when it came to medicine, it was a bit more complicated because the most prolific writer of antiquity in medicine and actually in general was a man called Galen. And he didn't write one convenient big sort of summation like Euclid and Ptolemy did. So he wrote, hundreds of treatises. They're still turning up in libraries, ones that we haven't heard of. So I focused on his texts that were used as part of the medical education. So the sort of the more basic ones, particularly those on anatomy and also some of the ones on pharmacology, medicines. So that was basically my sort of how I decided what to focus on. And then I very much stuck with those three men through the journey, on the journey through the Middle Ages.
And so before we begin talking about the particulars of the journey, as you describe it, it was striking to me, of course. And I knew beforehand I had a sense of how much had been lost from the ancient world. But really, it seems that this is truly just the tip of a large ancient iceberg that survives. And so can you talk about how much we don't know about the ancient world in terms of the books or texts that were produced?
Yes, I mean, we do, we know some of the things that were lost, but obviously there must have been a lot of books written that we there's no reference to, so we have no idea that they ever existed. But interestingly, in science, there's quite a high survival rate. It's higher in science than in other subjects. But it's a complicated picture because, so if I take, if you take the elements as an example, the elements wasn't new mathematics. The elements was Euclid sitting down in the Library of Alexandria and looking at all the available mathematical texts and ideas that had been produced in the preceding 2000 years by the Egyptians and the Babylonians and the Greeks. And he then sort of collated it and put it and produced it in this beautiful, lucid masterpiece. But what that meant was that nobody bothered recopying the texts that he based the elements on anymore, because why would they bother? They had the elements, which had it all there so clearly set out. So he had the effect of actually ensuring that the texts that went before didn't survive, which I think is quite an interesting sort of perhaps unexpected result of writing a very successful book in the ancient world, was that then I think it was a similar story for medicine and also for astronomy.
So ironically, you're starting this story seemingly at the beginning because we're thinking of the ancient authors, but in fact, there's a hidden history that we may never know, probably will never know, because there's, in other words, the Euclid and others were beginning in the middle of a longer story that had already predated them.
Yes, absolutely. And you could sort of see Euclid as a kind of a seminal moment in the much, much longer history of mathematics. And of course, he continued the ideas that had come from before, but the actual texts themselves were not reproduced. So yeah, I think it's a very interesting. It's almost a bit of a dichotomy that his book was so important, and his book in many ways ensured the survival of these ideas, but at the same time, it ensured that the texts it was based on didn't survive.
And so it's notable. I was really struck by the fact, this I did not know before about Galen, that you suggested roughly there are 6 million words surviving from the ancient world, and 3 million of them are Galen.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's, I think it's more than that, but I'm not sure if that's the exact figure. I can't remember if that's the exact figure, but yes, I think roughly half of the words that survive from the ancient world are written by Galen. He was not a man who was shy of telling people his opinions. I can imagine if you met him, he would be the ultimate mansplainer. He would just sit and talk and talk and talk. You wouldn't be able to get a word in edgeways.
And that's notable. Is presumably the reason the scientific works, the mathematical works, survive is because they were deemed useful by future generations. Perhaps the more artistic works, like the works of Aeschylus and Sophocles, were deemed perhaps more optional, entertaining, but nevertheless not essential. Is this part of the reason that scientific and mathematic works are surviving in greater proportion?
Yeah, I think possibly. Yes, I think so. I mean, I'm just going to have a quick look to check the numbers, but there are some really interesting statistics for the numbers of plays that survive.
Right. You mentioned Aeschylus, only 7 out of 80 Aeschylus
right.
plays yeah. survive, yeah. and Sophocles only 7 out of 120, and Euripides
exactly.
18 out of 92. And so that's an incredible attrition rate. And as you mentioned, there was a medieval or early late antiquity chronicler who kind of came up with his own Bartlett's quotations effectively, and only a small fraction of the quotations are from actual known surviving work. So it's really incredible,
right.
the attrition rate.
Yeah, it is. It is. But I think that's a feature of, and that demonstrates how expensive and difficult it was to reproduce books before the age of printing, because every single one had to be copied by hand. And that was an extremely, time consuming and expensive process.
And so I do want you to talk a bit about that before we get to the actual tracing of this history. Books or texts, as we would call them today, are these are all handwritten. We don't have a printing press in the West until the 15th century. And so you've got everything that's really written by a scribe, who is somebody who is handwriting this. And can you talk about some of the materials, like the ink and the quote unquote paper, or the material on which this is preserved?
Yeah, sure. So Euclid, Ptolemy, and Galen would have all written on papyrus scrolls. Papyrus is a type of reed which grows in the Nile Delta, and that was the primary writing material in the ancient world. Some other cultures who couldn't access papyrus would use bark or and animal skins, which became more and more popular, and the processes for producing what's called parchment, which is animal skins that have been soaked in lime, and then they scrape off all the flesh and sort of stretch them and rub the skin so it becomes really thin and suitable and smooth and suitable for writing on. And parchment became increasingly popular, but it was always expensive to produce, of course, because you need skins of animals, and then bits of it would be unusable because there would be holes, or they would be it would tear, and also the process of producing it was quite long and complex. But once around sort of 300-500, the book as we now know it started to come into being. It was called a codex, and it was basically parchment leaves which were glued together on one side, and then there were wooden boards as the covers, and they began to gradually replace scrolls, because scrolls are very fragile things, and you can imagine you have to roll up a scroll, roll it constantly to read it. So that wear and tear made them even more fragile. So gradually the codex written on parchment, animal skins, begins to take over, and it was particularly taken up by Christianity, by Christian writers. And so that became more popular, and that kind of book is much more durable. I mean, parchment, that there's some really extraordinary examples of particularly religious books and Bibles which have survived from the third, fourth century. It's really, really beautiful books. And then in in the 7th century, the Arabs got hold of, that they had a battle against the Chinese, and they took some Chinese soldiers prisoner, and these Chinese soldiers taught them how to make paper using rags and cotton material and other, you know, wood and that kind of thing, fibrous plants, and they taught them how to make paper, and the Arabs then took on this technology. And once paper started to be being produced, then that was cheaper to produce than parchment, and that it did have quite an important effect on the number of books being produced. And then I think ink, certainly in Baghdad in the 7th and 8th centuries, the quality of ink and glue was very much improved, and it made books easier to produce and more durable, which again would have had an effect on the cost of them, made them slightly cheaper and more accessible and that kind of thing.
But these are things that, so they've got to be copied over and over because they're going to disintegrate over time and through usage. And so, for example, if you start in the 3rd century BC with Euclid's putting something down onto papyrus, how many times in all likelihood would that original work have to be recopied and reproduced in order to survive into, say, Alexandria, Egypt over the next few hundred years?
Well, I think if you're very, very lucky, a papyrus scroll would have lasted maybe 200 years before it absolutely needed to be recopied. I mean, parchment, obviously, you know, it can survive much longer, but the books, you know, they had to be recopied. There had to be more than one copy of them, because if there's only one copy in the Library of Alexandria, and then it happened to be in, you know, the warehouse that Julius Caesar set fire to when he attacked the city in the 1st century, then it's lost, it's gone. So I think that was one of the really sort of compelling things about this story, is that, sometimes there would have probably have only been a handful of copies of these texts. And you know, that's just such a fragile, they could have been so easily lost, all of them. But yes, the recopying is absolutely vital. And every time you recopy something, you've obviously got to decide, am I going to recopy this book or that book? Am I going to put my money into this subject? Or so it's always a process of selection. And I suppose that's how some things disappear and get lost, and other things are, carried on.
So you start your account in Alexandria, Egypt, and explain why that's an important location, the point to begin at.
Well, Alexandria was the most important intellectual center in the ancient world for centuries. And it was founded by Alexander the Great. And then when he died, his general Ptolemy took over the whole province of Egypt. And Ptolemy was, Macedonian. He wasn't royal or particularly grand. And he decided that in order to found his dynasty properly and to really build up the prestige that he needed, because he didn't have it by birth, he was going to make this city into the absolute center of knowledge. And he did this in various ways. He founded the library and initiated a really aggressive policy of book collection. He would search ships, ships that were passing through the port searched, and if there were books on board, they would literally just help themselves and take them. They even had a special shelf mark in the library which was from the ships. So he was pretty unscrupulous, I think, but he was just really determined. And he also tempted scholars to come, and Euclid was probably one of these scholars. We think that Euclid was probably studying maths at the academy in Athens, and that he was tempted to come to Alexandria, but by King Ptolemy, who said, come, I've got this amazing library, there's all these other scholars, there's this great atmosphere. And this was really successful. Alexandria, from that point on, Alexandria was the place to be in the ancient world if you were well, in the Western ancient world, if you were a scholar and you were interested in learning, and you could come and share your ideas and, you know, have access to lots and lots of texts. And I think, you know, nowadays, it's hard to imagine just exactly how extraordinary that was in, you know, in the 3rd century BC. Nowadays, there's so many places on Earth. I mean, you know, you just have to go on your computer on Amazon, you can access hundreds of texts, you can go to libraries, you know, there's universities everywhere you look. And in the ancient world, that, you know, Alexandria was really the only place that had that kind of level of learning on offer. So he was very successful, Ptolemy, and it continued in that way until, I mean, really in the 5th century. So for 800 years, it was the top of the intellectual tree, which is a great achievement.
And so what marks its decline?
Well, by the 5th century, the Roman Empire had begun to sort of change and I don't want to say decline, but in the West, you know, it declined, and Constantinople had become the great sort of major city of the Roman Empire, and Alexandria just began to decline. The decline of the library had already begun years before. The city had become Christian, and of course many of the texts in the library were actually housed in a secondary library called the Serapeum, which was another temple, because in the ancient world books were often kept in temples. And the Christians that were rising to power in Alexandria in the early 5th century saw these texts as being a fundamental part of paganism, which they needed to stamp out. So this the Serapeum was destroyed and the texts within it by a mob of Christians. So the decline had been, you know, it's been very gradual, but quite inevitable. And then the city was conquered by the Arabs a couple of hundred years later, but they had their own, they founded their own cities and intellectual centers elsewhere. So Alexandria just declined. But I suppose it's inevitable, isn't it? I mean, places always rise and fall again.
Well, that's, you know, that brings up a point. Your reluctance to embrace the word decline versus change, I think, gives a hint of, there's an ongoing debate, isn't there, among scholars of the ancient world regarding the Roman Empire in the West in particular, as to whether it was a decline or simply an adaptation to changing conditions. Is that part of your reluctance to embrace that word?
Yes, I think it's a bit of a simplification to say that it was just a decline. And, you know, it goes right back to Edward Gibbon, you know, this how we see the process that happened over those centuries. And I just think it's a much more complicated and nuanced picture than just saying, oh, well, the Roman Empire disappeared, and, you know, because it didn't. And it's certainly not in the East, where it sort of survived and changed. And so, yeah.
But the infrastructure certainly does decline. I mean, it really does disintegrate in some ways. There's scholarship by Brian Ward Perkins, I believe, who came out with a book a little over a decade ago, where he traces the changes in everyday life before and after the Western Empire. And you see things like the average weight of cattle declines precipitously. Certainly, we have changes in everyday life that show a diminishment and a decline in standard of living. And it seems to me this is your account here in many ways reflects the experience of the Western Mediterranean at the demise of the empire, and how knowledge is, and this is a point you make yourself, which is the preservation and protection of knowledge is really greatly dependent upon political stability. And certainly by the end of the empire, there is anything but stability. And so can you talk about how stability is important and what role it plays in the different areas that you cover? You start with Alexandria and you go on to some other areas, of course, but political stability as a general concept and the role it plays.
Yeah, so political stability is absolutely vital on so many levels. So just on the first basic level of the fact that books are extremely fragile items, and if you have armies marching into your city and setting fire to the libraries, and obviously the books are going to be lost. But also on the level of funding, you know, scholarship needs to be funded. It's a long-term project. And if you are living in a state where the government, where there's no sort of strong government and there's warring factions, and there just isn't the available capital or the available long-term view, long-term, you know, ability to sort of plan long-term, which allows scholarship to flourish. So political stability is absolutely fundamental. And you see time and again in my book, each city that I visit, each new chapter, you know, it has its heyday, and then something goes wrong in terms of the, you know, the city's invaded, or perhaps a much more conservative, more religious faction comes into power, and then the whole intellectual project is comes under threat, and often the scholars will flee with their books and go somewhere else where the conditions are better.
So the role of Christianity in particular seems to be a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there is this iconoclasm and a rejection of the so-called pagan world. But at the same time, there is this desire on the part of people like Saint Benedict to preserve some of the elements of that pagan world. So can you explain this dichotomy?
Yes, a Christianity. Very, very complicated relationship especially with science, I think, and that continues, I think, right to this day. So in the early years, the decline of the Roman Empire, and you know Christianity increased in power, and Christianity in many areas, the Christian church kind of took over from the Roman state, and there are various incidences like the one I told you about with the Serapeum in Alexandria, where Christians were actually responsible for directly destroying pagan texts because of the fact that they were pagan. But then, of course, there were also places like the monastery, Cassiodorus, who was a scholar in Italy in the 5th century, and who was responsible for preserving at least some texts, scientific texts in Italy. And he was really, him and Boethius, they were really just the two of them who were trying to hang on to some of this knowledge. And he founded a monastery down on the very south coast of Italy, where he kept these texts and as part of the sort of classical education system. And so he had scribes copying them, and he also had quite a lot of texts in Greek. So it is a double-edged sword, because also as time went by, really the only place in the 5th and 6th centuries in the West, the only place where you could learn to read and write was in a monastery or in a religious institution. So on the one hand, Christianity was responsible for the loss of quite a lot of ancient ideas and texts, but on the other hand, it was responsible for the survival of literary culture and writing. And as you say, yeah, it's a double-edged sword. It's not a simple black and white story at all.
So let's move a little further east. As Christianity begins to dominate the Roman Empire, both in the West and in the East, there is a degree of intolerance for certain kinds of ideas, and some scholars feel pressured to leave and they migrate. And so talk about that. To me, that was the area where I was personally most ignorant about. I knew that the Muslim world in the 8th and 9th centuries was a preserve of Western knowledge, but I didn't really understand until reading your book how this process occurred. So if you could explain that key transition geographically.
Yeah. So the first part of the transition was that already by the third, fourth, and fourth centuries, there were a lot of other libraries in what is now Turkey and Syria and that part of the Middle East. So already books, you know, Euclid's Elements and Ptolemy's Almagest and books like that would have already been in libraries in, and also in Constantinople, of course. So that knowledge was had already been taken sort of from Alexandria, if you like, and out across the Eastern Mediterranean world and into the Middle East. And there were scholars who continued studying those scientific texts and recopying them and sort of keeping this little tiny flame, these tiny flames alive. And many of these scholars were associated with the Nestorian Church, which was a very early Christian church in Syria and modern day Middle East. And so that was a very important stage. And I didn't make, that wasn't a chapter in my book. And I actually did have a discussion with a very erudite scholar the other day. And he said, you know, really, that should have been an extra chapter in your book. So that's a very important stage in the transmission. Because, of course, when the Arabs conquered a lot of that area in the 7th century and founded Baghdad, that was where they went. They would travel off into Syria and that part of the Middle East, and then also up into Anatolia, which is now Turkey. And they also would wrote to the emperors in Constantinople and asked them for scientific books. And they were sent, you know, copies of Euclid's Elements and that kind of thing. So that was very important. Those books already were there, and that was where the Arabs then accessed them once they started to realize what was on offer in terms of ancient scientific ideas. And in Baghdad in the 8th and 9th centuries, there was this enormous program of textile acquisition, and scholars set off, you know, on these incredible journeys into the mountains to find old temples and to find, you know, to find scholars who'd maybe been handing these books down from generation to generation and sort of keeping them hidden in their houses. They brought them back to Baghdad, and then there was this enormous program of translation. Many of the books had already been translated into Syriac, which was the language of the Christians in that part of the world, the Nestorian Church, and they were then translated into Arabic. And of course, there was also a tradition of ancient Persian scholarship, which was already present in the area around Baghdad when the Arabs arrived, and they mined that tradition as well. They were really extraordinarily good at sort of taking ideas from wherever. And they also took ideas from China, the like paper, as I've already mentioned, but also from India, mathematical ideas and ideas about astronomy. So the scholars who assembled in Baghdad in those two centuries, and many of them were Persians, they weren't actually ethnically Arabs, but it's called Arabic science because they all wrote in Arabic, but they just did this amazing job of gathering all these important scientific ideas and kind of synthesizing them and going through the text, producing really good translations of them, and then also, you know, producing their own ideas. I mean, the achievement of Arabic science in Baghdad in those centuries is really absolutely astounding. And it's something that I really wasn't aware of when I started researching the book. And it became one of, you know, if there's one thing that I would hope that readers of my book take away, is just exactly how extraordinary these men were and what they achieved and what they, you know, we've inherited a lot of their ideas. So that was very exciting to discover all that.
And so, again, to return to one of these themes that you have about political stability, this thriving of this, and this is really centered in what is modern Baghdad.
Yeah.
And so this focal point where there's this drawing in of ideas and knowledge from all the different parts of the then known world is really catalyzed, it seems, through this political stability and the creation of an empire within this area. This is the Abbasid Empire under the inheritors or successors to Muhammad. And so this is really, again, akin to the Ptolemaic system, where you've got an imperial system after succeeding Alexander the Great. You've also got a strong system, imperial system in Baghdad. I was really struck by the fact that one of the caliphs, I believe it was Al-Rashid, who essentially gives his tutor, his lifelong tutor, carte blanche to use the imperial funds to collect what the use to which this tutor puts it is essentially a collection of books.
Yeah, and I would say when you asked me earlier about political stability, one of the other really, really vital factors for any kind of scholarship to flourish is that there has to be people in power who are interested and who are there were two or three of those caliphs who really were absolutely passionate about science themselves. It wasn't just, they weren't just doing it to, you know, I mean, obviously it was very helpful for them to have all these ideas to help run their empires and improve the logistics. And, you know, there was a lot of practical applications, but they actually were personally just really, really, you know, they were scholars in their own right, and they were very interested in these things. And of course, they created a fashion. And in Baghdad, in the ninth century, if you were a wealthy lord and you didn't have a library and you didn't have a room full of your own scholars and your own scribes producing manuscripts for you, then, I mean, you were no one. You couldn't hold your head up at dinner parties and stuff. And I think that's so fascinating how, you know, something becomes a trend like that. And suddenly, you know, it just causes an explosion in the production of knowledge, because these incredibly wealthy people families were, you know, pouring money into this endeavor, and translators were paid really, really well. They were sort of the premier, how can I put it so it relates to an American audience, the top baseball players of the day. You know, they were getting paid an absolute fortune, it just had such positive consequences for what they were able to achieve and discover.
Well, today we would call this kind of an amassing of social capital, right?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
You have this. I mean, and really, this is very familiar. This strikes us. Much of the ancient world, of course, from Homer onward, these people in some ways are very readily understood by the modern sensibility in terms of social and distinction. And you know, we've all seen libraries where these wonderfully bound volumes look like you pull them down from the shelf.
Yeah, they've never been read.
Yeah. But nevertheless, they carry a sense of interest, reputation can be enhanced through the possession of them, et cetera. And so I was really struck by what a true center of learning. On the one hand, yes, there are these reputational effects, but also the preservation of knowledge is incidentally maintained because you've got all of these private libraries, but also you have public libraries. You noted at one point when the Mongols invade Baghdad in the 13th century, there are apparently 36 public libraries, many of which are destroyed, I gather. Yeah. But nevertheless, that is notable in and of itself, 36 public libraries in an ancient city. But at the same time, you've got all these private libraries, which presumably some of them survived better than the public ones. And so there's this incidental survival rate from these private libraries that is really important for these texts, many of which would disappear once the libraries burned.
Yes, and I think also, you know, that was just Baghdad. But of course, by then, the book culture in the Arabic world was enormous. I mean, it was really, it was an extremely lucrative. And of course, book agents were selling books and transporting books all over the Islamic Empire. So, there were great libraries in countless other cities as well. Baghdad sort of set the tone, but you know, before long, as the empire began to break up and most provinces had their own sort of ruling families, they all wanted to be like the Abbasids, and they all wanted that. So it's had this incredible ripple effect, not just within Baghdad, but also right the way out to, you know, as far as Cordoba in Spain, which is my next chapter, where the Umayyads, they founded the most incredible libraries as well. And again, there were private libraries, and this sort of whole atmosphere of studying and discovering and trying to really to push the boundaries of knowledge, which I think, yeah, I just think it just sounds like a really great period to live through.
And so you have this importance of military rulers who are interested in this, but at the same time, I want you to talk about the problem of what I would call the problem of translation. And even today, of course, if somebody publishes a novel in French and then it's translated into English here in the U.S., there's sometimes discussions about the faithfulness to the translation and whether the translator, and in some ways, is a second author. And I would imagine that these problems are squared in the translation of works in the ancient world, from the ancient world into the medieval world. So you talk about in the 11th century, there's a translator named Constantine the African, mm-hmm. Who translated a lot of Galen, the ancient physician, prolific physician, author. And there's some concern there about, you know, how faithful he is to the original, because in many ways he's got different purposes for his translation. So Constantine wants to use practical teaching texts. So can you explain, you know, how much of a problem it is for us to understand the ancients via the translators?
Yeah, I think the first thing to say is that it slightly depends on the text. I think a text like Euclid's Elements, which is, it begins by setting out the vocabulary that he's going to use. And the vocabulary is limited. It's very scientific. And the concepts are, so literally the first line of the Elements is, he describes what he means when he says a point. A point is something which has no part. And then he describes what he means when he says a line. So I think with a text like that, the translation, so long as the translation is good, it's not so much an issue. Also, there are diagrams, which are absolutely fundamental. So as long as you have a faithful translation and you have the diagrams with Euclid's Elements, it's quite a simple translation. There aren't loads of words. There aren't loads of possible ways of interpreting the meaning because it is so clearly set out with this technical vocabulary. But when it comes to Galen, it's different, of course, because he's writing about medicine and he's using an enormous vocabulary. And as I said, he's incredibly wordy anyway. He's not a man to use two words, if he can use 10 words instead of two, he will. He loves the sound of his own voice, so it was definitely more of a problem with works like that. And I think even more so in philosophy, texts of philosophy, I think even more so, because where the meaning is perhaps obscured or complicated, and even a mistranslation of one word can completely change the meaning, I think then that was very difficult. And of course, if you have a text that's been translated from Greek to Syriac to Arabic to Latin, that's a lot of different minds and different languages it's gone through. It's a bit like Chinese whispers. You're probably going to end up with something at the end which is quite different from what from the beginning. But from early on, so there was a translator in Baghdad called Hunayn ibn Ishaq, and he was really the sort of set the standards for translation, for scientific translation. And he actually translated a lot of Galen. And he was very, very rigorous. And one of the things that he instituted was that you had to go out and find as many copies of the text as you could. It wasn't enough to just have one manuscript and translate it. You had to really produce a proper collated version of the manuscript and then translate it. So he introduced much higher standards for translation. But then when it came to Constantine the African, that it is an interesting question, because he actually translated a lot of the works which Hunayn had written based on Galen. So this whole idea of it being a very faithful translation, it was already quite often, often, if it was a very big book, then the translator would sort of produce almost like a Reader's Digest version of it, a clearer, more concise, more easy to use version. And then, then that would be retranslated. And I think the problem came for Constantine the African. The problem was that he often didn't even attribute the authorship. So he made it almost sound like he had written the text, which, of course, he hadn't, because he was you know, he was taking it from an Arabic text and then, you know, changing it around and making it his own a bit, but it was based on somebody else's words. And I think that's where the problem comes in. But the thing is that in the ancient world, the whole idea of copying someone, it didn't have the same negative connotations that it has today. You know, if you think of a lot of Roman literature, you know, the Aeneid is basically the Odyssey. It's just the Roman version. So I think they had different ideas of about copying and about sort of copyright. Copyright didn't exist. But Constantine the African was definitely has been accused by modern scholars of plagiarism. And I think partly he was trying to, as you said, adapt his texts for teaching and also for a European audience. And I think if we take one example, he translated a book which Hunayn had written, which was based on Galen, and he renamed it and he gave it a Greek name. And I think the reason he did that was because he was trying to highlight the link with the ancient Greeks. But of course, that was at the expense of Hunayn and the Arabic tradition. And that was very much the beginning of the sort of editing out of the Arabic contribution, which continued in the Renaissance. And you know, in the Renaissance, the whole sort of foundation of humanism was this idea that you have to get back to the original text. It's not good enough. You know, these centuries of translation through Arabic and Latin have just corrupted the original words of these ancient geniuses. And they became completely and utterly obsessed with getting hold of texts in the original Greek. And of course, that was very much to the detriment of you know, the Arabic scholars and also the scholastic Latin sort of, you know, late medieval scholars who'd done so much work on these texts. And so, yeah, it's a sort of long, it's a long process. But I think translation is a complicated thing, but without it, we wouldn't have any of these texts. You know, if they hadn't translated them into different languages, then they wouldn't have survived. So it's very important.
And for our American listeners, what you call Chinese whispers, which I think is the British version of it, telephone is what we call
it. Oh, well, sorry. Yeah.
Kids here. And so, but yes, it, you know, the problem that you've been describing, it seems that these Renaissance era scholars are in some ways, it seems to me somewhat logical. Or pragmatic from their standpoint, they would approach it as, why do we have to go through this long chain of translation where no doubt they would be aware of the possibility of error? Why not go back, you know, error as in mistranslation or omissions from the original? Why not go back to the quote unquote original Greek? So unintentionally cutting out some of the, at which, as you've noted, are new additions or contributions of these Arabic speaking scholars. So is there something lost for these Renaissance era translators when they are trying to go to what they see or understand to be the original? Are they missing out on some added new knowledge?
Well, I think they would have been if those, so the first printed editions of most of the texts that I was following were actually based on the versions which we'd followed all along through Arabic. And so I think they would have done if they'd sort of completely ignored those versions, then yes, they would. But many, you know, many of the ideas, if you take the example of the Hindu Arabic numerals, which had come from from India and then were popular, were written about in Baghdad in the 9th century, and then gradually made their way, that they're the numerals that we use now, you know, 1 to 9 and the 0, on which the entire of modern mathematics is based. That idea came through, even though that was very much through the Arabic. You know, we wouldn't have had it if it wasn't for the Arabic tradition. So I think that the really negative thing that happened was that the Arabic contribution was written out of history effectively and ignored. And I think that was the really negative effect. The idea still came through, but that's really the negative thing that happened.
Well, you describe it as negative because I want to make sure I understand what you mean by that. You mean it's lamentable, alas,
yeah,
that we
yeah.
Yeah. But it's not, in other words, it's not an intentional writing out of their contribution.
Well, I don't know. I think in some cases it was quite intentional. I think there was, you know.
Is that because of religious differences? Yeah. In other words, a prejudice against somebody who is an adherent to a different faith?
Yeah, absolutely. And also you have to remember in the case of Constantine the African, when he was, you know, there were still battles going on between the Christian forces and the Muslim forces. So, I mean, it's not that it wasn't, you know, understandable, but it was there was a definite suspicion and, look at the Crusades. That was all happening at the same time. We were actually fighting each other. So it's sort of understandable that there was this this negative feeling from, you know, from Christians to Muslims, and definitely with the zero, because it came from the Muslim world, that it took centuries for it to be accepted, and people were quite suspicious, and they thought that perhaps it was demonic and it was dangerous because it had come from the Muslim world. So I think, you know, you can understand it's not a laudable attitude to have, but it is understandable in many ways that Christians felt that way about Arabic scholarship.
So one element of the late medieval, early Renaissance period that I found very intriguing were these individuals that are essentially manuscript hunters. So can you explain some of these people? What do they do? What motivates them?
I think that's one of the most fascinating aspects of the story. So there were many of them. I mean, the man Hunayn ibn Ishaq, he's one of the sort of very early ones in Baghdad, and he just set off and traveled for years looking for manuscripts, and he taught himself fluent Greek so he could translate them, and then there was another one was called Gerard of Cremona. He was the greatest translator of scientific texts from Arabic into Latin. And he was the same. He was born in Northern Italy. He was very interested in astronomy as a young man, and he learned everything he could in Northern Italy about astronomy. And then he realized he was going to have to go elsewhere because he'd literally read every book there was. And somebody told him that Toledo in Northern Spain, which had just been reconquered by the Christians, was full of Arabic books on astronomy. And he'd heard about the Almagest and he wanted to see it for himself. So off he set into the unknown, you know, weeks of traveling by boat and, I don't know, donkey or walking or however he got there. But, you know, travel in the medieval world was not not speedy, and it wasn't comfortable, and it often wasn't safe either. And then he got to Toledo, and of course, he got hold of a copy of the Almagest, but then it was in Arabic, so he couldn't read it. But he wasn't deterred by this. He just learned Arabic and then spent the rest of his life in Toledo translating all these scientific texts. I just think that's incredible. I mean, that's real dedication. And, you know, to go back to what I was saying about in the modern world, it's so easy for us to access information. And you know, imagine if you wanted to study something, you had to, you know, travel for weeks and weeks into the unknown and then learn an entirely new language. And, you know, it's just quite breathtaking, I think, the lengths that these men went to make sure that knowledge was passed down. And
it really is notable, the dedication, because their lives are dedicated to this over a period of years, decades, in some instances. And is it religious dedication? In other words, are these men that believe that the truth of the world is revealed through other scholars? In other words, they are dedicated to a truth that they think God has revealed to the world? Or are these more secular motives?
I don't know. I think that's quite hard to say. But I think I don't think you could say they were doing it for religious reasons. I'm sure they were. You know, generally, most people seem to believe in God, and you know that God was very much a sort of integral part of everyday life, and being a Christian or being a Muslim. But no, I think they were motivated by in the same way that modern scientists are just. They just have this drive. They're just fascinated by subjects, and they want to discover more. And they want to. I think it was a very personal, and Yeah, I don't. I don't know a lot about religion. I've never really studied the history of religion, so I'm always a little bit nervous when I have to get too involved and talk too much about it, because I feel that, I don't know, perhaps I have a slightly negative view of religion. If you study the history of science, religion does not come out as being a particularly positive force over time. So I don't know. Who knows?
Well, of course, some of the greatest scientists, even into the well into the early modern period, up through the 17th and 18th century, they are religious. They're devout, but they believe they're revealing the truth of the world, a deeper truth that's not through their empiricism that's been hidden, not by God, but rather by the inability of people to utilize reason. And so this is part of what the Enlightenment is. It's not merely secular. It's also built upon religious motives of some of these scientists. And so I was just curious if maybe that was perhaps motivating some of these manuscript hunters to seek out the truth that they thought been hidden.
That is totally likely. And I think, you know, it's difficult for us to imagine now, because we live in a world where religion is so much a personal choice. You know, in the medieval period, and in medieval Islam, you know, religion was just, it was just all pervasive. I mean, you just, not believing was, I mean, of course there are instances of people who were unbelievers, but it was not really an option. It was not something that you would have been really, really out on a limb if you were prepared to say that you didn't believe in God. I think God was just sort of in everything. So of course, if you, no matter what you did, whatever, what job you did, it would have been, you know, in the service of God in some way or other, definitely.
So one of the last areas that you cover is Venice during its heyday, and you talk about also printing presses. So can you explain the role that Venice plays and why it's so important for Western Europe?
Venice was one of the first great centers of printing. It wasn't where printing was developed in Europe. That was in Germany, but it spread very, very quickly. And that was because the rulers of Venice were extremely wise and canny individuals, and they were very good at spotting a business opportunity. And as soon as news spread about this incredible new technology, they basically invited printers from Germany to come, and they gave them licenses to build printing presses and produce books in Venice. And that was one of the reasons why Venice became such a big center of printing so quickly. And it was also the most important place for printing scientific texts in the early period, in the sort of first 100 years. It wasn't really a center of scientific inquiry in the same way that the other cities had been, but it was where all the texts which I followed throughout my book were printed for the first time around 1500, some of them a little bit before and some of them a little bit afterwards. So it was really important for that. And it was a great center of scholarship. And of course, it was also a place where after the sack of Constantinople in 1453, scholars came bringing their ancient Greek texts with them. And so that added another whole dimension learning in the city, because the humanists were able to access the texts in the original Greek as well. So that was another dimension.
And of course, you end your account around 1500, but nevertheless, it's striking that every now and then there's still something new that's discovered. You mentioned there was a French researcher who in 2005 discovered a treatise by Galen in regard to, the title apparently is On the Avoidance of Grief. And this was at a monastery in Thessaloniki. And so there may still be texts out there yet to be discovered, probably authored by Galen, though.
Definitely. Yeah, I think, he wrote so much. I should think we'll probably still be finding texts written by him in hundreds of years' time. I don't know. But I think that's just so exciting. You know, that idea that, people have been studying Galen for almost 2000 years, and yet still there's stuff out there that's new and hasn't been discovered yet. And I just think that that's, you know, imagine being that researcher, how their heart must have just stopped when they realized it was a completely new treatise that hadn't been seen before. So yes, my advice is become a manuscript hunter. Go and get access to all those monastic libraries in Greece and that part of the world, and see if you can come up with something new that hasn't been discovered before.
So after you did this research and wrote this book, what's your opinion on the whole of the preservation of knowledge as a project? Is it really, granted, we've already noted how the vast majority of knowledge that was lost from the ancient world, but even today, there's a concern with how knowledge is preserved. In other words, digital capacity is immense. But at the same time, there's a lot that's probably in some ways useless, trivial. And so what survives, if you had asked a Roman in the first century AD what would survive, they would probably have assumed a lot more would survive than actually did, alas. But do you see the project of preserving knowledge as a really fragile, delicate project that requires robust individuals, or is this less of a problem today because of our digital and electronic capacity?
It would seem that way on the face of it, but actually I think digital information is possibly even more fragile than material information. I mean, it is possible that, I don't know, who knows what technology can do, but if somehow the plug was pulled, or I don't know, some kind of, I mean, who knows? I'm not into science fiction, but I'm sure there's a lot of science fiction films out there that imagine this scenario. But, I think we could lose, all of digital information if somebody was clever enough to come up with the algorithm, or I don't know, the internet suddenly disappeared. But I think what another interesting thing is that, for a historian like me of the ancient and medieval world, it's always about, you've got maybe three or four tiny fragments of information, and then you have to try and build your story around it and try and kind of, recreate the reality. But historians of the age that we're living in now, so people in hundreds of years' time, their problem is going to be the opposite. They are going to be trawling through billions and billions and billions of pieces of information, and I just wonder how that will throw up its own problems and issues. And I think it'd be very interesting to see what they would be and how history, the writing of history will change, whether that would, I don't know how research would how would you research? I just think that's very interesting. Even in my own career, since I started university 20 years ago, your ability to search for information has been transformed by the internet and by all those academic journals are now on databases, and you can literally type in the word that you're interested in, and it will come up with every single in just a couple of seconds. And I think that's a really interesting aspect of scholarship, is how it's changing and how it will change for historians of the future.
The book is entitled The Map of Knowledge, A 1,000-Year History of How Classical Ideas Were Lost and Found. We've been joined today by the author, Violet Muller. Violet, thank you so much for joining us on New Books Network.
Thank you very much.